You've been in office for 3.5 years.
And Donald Trump has been running for office.
But you've been the person holding the office.
Come on.
Madam
you
Vice
and I
President.
Both know what I'm talking about. You and I both know what I'm talking about.
I actually don't. What are you talking about?
Yeah, I was wrong. I was wrong. I hate to start a show this way, but I actually have to confess I was wrong, ladies and gentlemen. I mean, my wife is listening to the show this morning. She's up early, and she has to hear me say this. And it's not something I enjoy saying, but I was wrong. I didn't think that Kamala Harris could do any worse than the Bill Whitaker interview on 60 Minutes. I was wrong. Oh, man.
So you're saying Bret Baier is a little bit different than the sycophants on The View.
Oh, my goodness.
Is there anything you'd change after 3.5 years of the Biden administration, Madam Vice President? No, nothing I can think of.
Oh, boy. I mean, right now, the conversation that they're having, we've heard about contention between the Biden crowd in the White House and the Kamala Harris staffers in the White House.
Okay.
Today, the blame is who allowed her to do this interview. That's the problem. That's the contention. That's the finger pointing going on within just Team Kamala. It's not the Biden people they can blame. They got to blame themselves for this one.
And
what a fiasco.
To drill down on that, a little bit of it was the criticism that she hasn't done interviews. And then the little bit of it was, you know, maybe Kamala Harris can go on, do this interview on Fox News with Bret Baier. And maybe she could connect with some undecided voters or people who aren't thrilled about Trump. And she dropped that chance.
Well, you could see the rationale. Hey, there's nowhere to go but up.
Okay, yeah.
Well, yeah, there was.
apparently, up was more difficult.
Have you seen the headline in Babylon Bee?
I didn't see Babylon Bee today.
Headline in this morning's Babylon Bee. Democrats wondering if it's too late to go back to Joe Biden. Yikes. Oh, my goodness. We got to get into this, and we will in just a moment here on the Thursday edition, or as Philip J. Vandenberg III likes to say, the Friday Eve edition of the John Carlson Show. If you would like to weigh in with your comments, your questions, your observations about Kamala Harris' interview with Bret Baier last night, you are welcome to do so at 206-421-5757. That is 206-421-5757. I want to start where Bret Baier, during the course of the interview, asked Kamala Harris about Americans' belief by an overwhelming margin, almost 4-1, that America is on the wrong track. You know, the old right track, wrong track dualism. Is America on the right track or the wrong track? 79% in the latest Marquette poll, it says we're on the wrong track. 21% we're on the right track. And so with that as your backdrop, here is how the conversation commenced. Oops, we are not, apparently I'm not... tabbed up here. Let's try it again.
More than 70% of people tell the country is on the wrong track. They say the country is on the wrong track. If it's on the wrong track, that track follows 3.5 years of you being vice president and President Biden being president. That is what they're saying, 79% of them. Why are they saying that? If you're turning the page, you've been in office for 3.5 years.
And Donald Trump has been running for office.
But you've been the person holding the office.
Come on.
Madam
Vice
President.
You and I both know what I'm talking about. You and I both know what I'm talking about.
I actually don't. What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is that over the last decade, people have become...
But
oh, man. You know what I'm talking about. No, I really don't know what you're talking about. First of all, why is this the first time you've heard Kamala Harris ask this question? Why did this not come up when she did the interview with Dana Bash on CNN? Why did this not come up during her debate with Donald Trump? The overwhelming majority of Americans think we're on the wrong track. You've been in office for 3.5 years. A lot of changes have taken place in terms of policy and in terms of the results of those policies during that time. Why do you think 3/4 of Americans think we're on the wrong track? That's a really good, fair question. And it's even more resonant since Kamala Harris went on The View expecting a very friendly reception, and she got a very friendly reception, so friendly that she let her guard down. And Sonny Hostin, who is an uber liberal attorney, just says, oh, by the way, is there anything you would have done different from Joe Biden? And she says, I can't think of anything. So she's the candidate of change, but she can't think of anything she would have done differently than one of the most unpopular presidents in the modern era. She can't think of anything that she would do different, even though 3/4 of the American people think we're on the wrong track. So that tells you a lot about Kamala Harris. It also tells you a lot. It tells you a lot about Kamala Harris, which is that there's not much there. No, there. If she does offer change, it's simply more change in the leftward direction. And Bret Baier was unfailingly polite. There was crosstalk when she started to filibuster, and she started to filibuster a lot. But these are very fair questions. These were not hostile questions asked in a hostile way. These were the kinds of questions that an incumbent administration, whether it's a president running for re-election or a vice president running to succeed the president, like George H.W. Bush succeeding Ronald Reagan in 88, Al Gore wanting to succeed Bill Clinton in 2000. These are the kinds of questions you expect. And the media, by and large, have been so tame that they didn't do this. Bill Whitaker was the first guy who really did his job. And she floundered on 60 Minutes. And the Democrats, the internal polling here has the Democrats very worried. The internal polls show what I think, whether you're a Democrat, Republican, or in between, whether you're a Kamala supporter or a Donald Trump supporter, I think you sense this, that the momentum in this race has been shifting. It's been moving away from Harris. I don't even want to say it's been moving to Trump. Donald Trump is Donald Trump. But a lot of the euphoria that was all around her when Joe Biden left the race and she was the anointed one because there was no time for the Democrats to have an actual competition to succeed Biden. And then there was their convention, which was obviously just a coronation. And then her debate performance against Donald Trump. So she had all this momentum at her back and had like a 5-point lead in the polls. And then it went away. And now the race is too close to call. And in the swing states, there are 7 states that will decide the presidency. There are the Midwest industrials of Michigan and Wisconsin, and a little further east, Pennsylvania. Then you've got down south, Georgia and North Carolina. And then out west, you've got Arizona and Nevada. Those are the states that are still undecided. And Trump is ahead of her in almost all of them. Or he's very close to her. Now, you go back in time, 4 years. You know, how is Kamala doing at this point in these swing states compared to how Donald Trump was doing? In Pennsylvania, 4 years ago, on this very day, October 17th, Biden was ahead 5.5 points. Today, in Pennsylvania, Trump is ahead by just under half a percentage point. In Michigan, on this day, 4 years ago, Biden was ahead 7.2 points. That's pretty good. But now Donald Trump is ahead in Michigan by a point. You go to Wisconsin. And again, Biden was ahead 4 years ago, 6.1 points, 6 points. Kamala Harris is ahead, but by less than a point. So this is what has the Democrats nervous. She is losing ground everywhere except deep blue states. In deep blue states, and Washington's won, the brand new poll just out, she's actually doing better than Biden was doing. But in the states that matter, in the Electoral College, she's underperforming and her people are nervous, and that's why she went on Bret Baier. And the argument was, again, she's got nowhere to go but up. And she's not going to go up from this. We've got plenty of clips to play for you. Here is how, well, we'll play for a bit how she stumbled on immigration. But here she was asked about Joe Biden's, or she was attacking Donald Trump's mental acuity and his stability and his age. Again, Kamala Harris has been attacking Donald Trump on these grounds. So Bret Baier asked the obvious question.
You call Donald Trump, he's misguided. You say now he's unstable.
He is unstable, Bret.
He's not well. You say he's mentally not stable.
He's not stable.
Let me ask you this. You told many interviewers that Joe Biden was on his game, that ran around circles on his staff. When did you first notice that President Biden's mental faculties appeared diminished?
That was a 2.5 second gap. When did you first notice that Joe Biden was having troubles? Because she was among the last people to step away from the public judgment that he was doing just fine.
Biden, I have watched from the Oval Office to the Situation Room, and he has the judgment and the experience to do exactly what he has done in making very important decisions on behalf of the American people. Joe Biden is not on the ballot.
I understand.
And Donald Trump, after George Clooney said within a few minutes of talking to President Biden at a fundraiser
that he thought this was not the same Joe Biden that we saw on the debate stage.
Donald Trump is on the ballot.
I understand. You met with him at least once a week for 3.5 years. You didn't have any concerns?
I think the American people have a concern about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think some American people have concerns now about Kamala Harris. is what I think. And understand, as issues like the economy and inflation and all of the problems that have emerged from the open border, from the huge imposition on small communities of large numbers of people in the country illegally, don't speak the language, pressing on social services and schools and the problems with crime and the like. The problem that the team Kamala is trying to come up with a strategy. What do? Well, we change the subject. We need to make Donald Trump's age and mental stability the issue. We need to get off of issues. We need to get away from the economy. We need to, you know, inflation, the border, crime. None of that, talking about that doesn't help us. We need other issues to be top of mind. So we need to talk up abortion. We need to talk up Donald Trump. And he's not just, and by the way, they know that this is dangerous. They know there have been two attempts on Donald Trump's life in the past 4 months. Two attempts on his life. And what are they doing now? Calling him a Nazi. Jim Carville calling Donald Trump a Nazi who wants to round up his political opponents, who even wants to round up people by race. And Kamala Harris radio interview just day before yesterday. And it was probably a prearranged call into the station as she was on Charlemagne the God. Very large black audience, very large popularity, particularly on the East Coast, syndicated program. And someone said, I'm concerned that Donald Trump is going to round up everyone who's not white. And she said, you've raised a very important point. But I tell you something, these people are not only desperate, but they are willing to create an even more toxic environment around Donald Trump in this election season than they already have. Anyway, it's going to be toxic around Kamala Harris's campaign headquarters today as they have to figure out who to blame for this. We've got more clips straight ahead. Philip J. Vandenberg III with the social media sweep. It's 21 minutes after 6. Good morning. So glad you are with me, ladies and gentlemen. Philip J. Vandenberg III's favorite segment, social media from socialists. What's going on?
Well, let's talk about election stuff and Jonathan Cho spotted something that he wanted to single out with a picture. So it's a bit of a visual daily double. The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. Ballots are being mailed out.
And we like Jonathan Cho. He's formerly with Como TV, now basically an independent journalist with a much larger audience.
Discovery
National
Institute.
Audience.
Exactly.
Now.
But Jonathan Cho has posted a picture. And it's a garbage can, but somebody in Seattle has, and the garbage can at the bottom of it does say Seattle Public Utilities, so it seems to be City of Seattle specific. And somebody has slapped a sticker right underneath the opening to deposit trash in the garbage can with a sticker that says Republican Ballot Drop Box. So Seattle, as Jonathan Cho adds. So that's
Are we surprised?
It's more that welcoming, diverse inclusion that Seattle is known for, right?
Are we surprised? By the way, I love Brandi Cruz has a sign stealer, a woman who was stealing yard signs for initiatives, the Natural Gas Initiative.
Yeah.
And when confronted, she said, well, yes, I can take it. I disagree with it.
Oh, wow. Yeah. I didn't listen to any of it, but I saw that she posted something in relation to that. But that's the mentality. And, you know, I talked about this a week ago on one of the different social media sweeps that I had seen 4 or 5 of those yard signs on Lake City Way on a Sunday. And then when I drove home on a Tuesday afternoon, Four of the five were gone, and one that was remaining was laying flat on the ground. It was no longer up. Somebody intentionally knocked them down and removed a bunch of them. But that's what passes for, you know, intellectual thought in the city of Seattle as it relates to some of these election items. Let's hit this one. This one probably dovetails with all of this. Yesterday, there was a no on 2117 rally or event, and the supporters of the no on 2117 campaign were talking about how if I-2117 passes, this is the cap and invest repeal,
the invisible
that ultimately
gas tax
affects our gas and diesel prices, that if it's repealed, it's going to hurt Washington State's effort to get these hybrid electric ferries that Jay Inslee has been holding out for. Listen to their campaign event yesterday.
Rejecting 2117 is critical to funding the five new clean electric boats that will restore our system and restore a safer and healthier future for our marine highways.
Because the state ferry system has been doing such a bang-up job under the Inslee administration, and the Inslee administration can't even bring in these hybrid electric ferry boats for anywhere close to what they've initially estimated.
Well, not only that, the amount they estimated is 2.5 times what it costs to build a diesel ferry.
Yeah.
So why would we be spending that kind of money when the ferry service is raising ferry fees, fares to go across the water because they're short on money?
Yeah.
Why would we be spending 2.5 times what we need to build a ferry boat?
Pertinent question.
Each and every one of those ferry boats, when we supposedly are running in the red in the ferry service, so we need to raise ferry fares. It is coming up here, 6:30, the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. We have a lot of other things going on the show, but right now, Everybody, they don't love train wrecks, but they can't look away. And right now, the Kamala Harris interview with Bret Baier appears to be a political train wreck. Also, an update right around the corner here on that missing Navy Growler. They have found the wreckage. They haven't found the crew members. At the top of the hour, we're going to be talking with the Secretary of State here in Washington, Steve Hobbs. I want to ask Steve Hobbs how we check to ensure that every voter in Washington State is, as is required in the U.S. Constitution, a U.S. citizen. Because in the state of Virginia, they found 6,000 non-citizens on the voting rolls. And they're not charging them with committing fraud, falsely registering to vote when they don't have a right to vote in the United States as a non-citizen. But they are giving them 14 days to explain what they're doing on the voting rolls when they're not citizens. And if they can't come up with a convincing reason like, oh, I am actually a citizen, then they'll be removed from the voting rolls. The Biden Justice Department is trying to prevent Virginia from removing them from voting rolls, even though they are non-citizens and they have admitted to being non-citizens. So I'm going to ask what we're doing here in Washington, and it'll be a very good conversation. I know Steve Hobbs. He was a moderately liberal state senator from Lake Stevens up in Snohomish County. Actually, pretty good guy. Served his country for decades in the National Guard. Anyway, in fact, he's an officer. Looking forward to our conversation. And that's going to be at 7:05 this morning. But I want you to, if you have a chance, watch ABC News tonight, David Muir, to see if he reverses something that he said during the debate between Donald Trump and Kamala Harris. You remember that David Muir interjected during the debate when Trump was complaining about all the increases in violent crime, that FBI statistics actually show violent crime is down in America. First of all, that's very misleading, and we'll point out why here in just a moment. But secondly, the FBI has now revised its crime data. It said, you know, come to think of it, we've updated our numbers here and corrected some previous data. Violent crime in America is not going down. It's going up. It's going up about 4.5%. So I wonder if David Muir will say, you know, call attention to the fact that during the debate, he had mentioned the FBI had said crime was going down and that now the FBI is reversing its position. So it might be fun for you to check out tonight. See if David Muir, if he doesn't fact check himself, since he erroneously fact checked Donald Trump, let's see if he if he just updates what he had said previously. So anyway, here is why I say that the FBI numbers are misleading. There's an organization called American Main Street Initiative. And Jeffrey Anderson, who's the president of this organization, is someone who believes that a lot of information people get in America is factually not accurate. And one example he uses is crime and the so-called fact check from David Muir. He has impeccable statistics, by the way. He is a former data guy at the Department of Justice. Here is what he said. This was even before the FBI corrected its numbers.
Contrary to the fact checkers and the debate, the moderators slash fact checkers, there's no statistically significant evidence in the best, most authoritative source that crime is dropping in America. I'm Jeff Anderson. I'm the president of the American Main Street Initiative. I used to be the director of the Bureau of Justice Statistics at the Department of Justice. That's the arm of DOJ that puts out all the federal crime stats. There's been a huge increase in urban crime from 2019, right before the summer of George Floyd and the Defund the Police movement, to 2023, which are the most recent numbers, which were just released a couple of weeks ago. In fact, the increase in urban crime, violent crime, is 40% over that period of time. And if you take out simple assaults, which are the least serious form of violent crime, then it's 54% is the increase. So it's a huge crime spike in our cities.
Crime in this country is through the roof.
President Trump, as you know, the FBI says overall violent crime is actually coming down in this country. But
FBI defrauded statements. They didn't include the worst cities. They didn't include the cities with the worst crime.
When you were corrected, Trump, during the debate, I was quite frustrated and yelling at the TV screen because I know that the stats he was citing are highly questionable. Those were partial year, incomplete stats from the FBI. And even the FBI's completed stats at the end of the year are highly problematic at this point in terms of making year-to-year comparisons. They're missing a whole host of agencies. They don't have them reporting to them, including the LAPD. 15% of the nation's law enforcement agencies didn't report. They've got a different mix of agencies from year to year, so it's not an apples-to-apples comparison. And they changed their whole system in 2021. So before 2021 to after, you really can't make any sense of the FBI numbers in terms of the trajectory of crimes.
And now the FBI has updated its numbers, and they reflect more of what Jeffrey Anderson here was just reporting, that crime is actually much, by significant double digits worse than it was 5 years ago. So thought you would want to know that. All right, let's bring it home local here for a couple of minutes. Authorities, after we got off the air yesterday, located the wreckage of that crashed U.S. Navy Growler yesterday afternoon. It's just east of Mount Rainier. They cannot find the crew. The two aviators on board are missing. And, you know, what could have become of them? Well, here's the latest from Como 4's Hannah Knowles.
The Navy says the EA-18G Growler jet was flying out of Naval Air Station Whidbey Island on a routine training flight when service went radio silent. Rescue crews circulating a 40-mile search radius when they discovered the wreckage east of Mount Rainier, but no sight of the pilots. That crew and first responders now face mountainous terrain, cloudy weather, and low visibility. John Nance served as a commercial and military pilot. He says it's worrisome we haven't received a down signal from the two pilots.
To hear nothing is a very dark omen. If they had been able to bail out, we probably would have had the opportunity to hear an emergency locator beacon of one sort or another.
And no indication that that has happened. So when we find out more, we will let you know. The Growler is built by Boeing. They run about $67 million apiece. This particular aircraft is from a squadron known as the Zappers. They returned in July from a combat deployment. They were on the USS Dwight D. Eisenhower aircraft carrier in the Southern Red Sea and the Gulf of Aden. That's a pretty hot zone. They conducted seven strikes, pre-planned strikes, into Yemen, area controlled by the Houthi rebels. So these are among our best, America's best, and these guys just on what was called a routine training mission, and they just went silent. So hopefully we'll get some good news. You know, fingers crossed. And prayers on the way for their safe return. It is 46 and a half minutes after 6 o'clock in the morning. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. You want to drop us a line, either a phone call or a text message? Same number for both. 206-421-5757. 206-421-5757. 421-5757. Our good buddy Lars Larson, our noon to three host, checking in right around the corner. Good to have you with us. It is 8 minutes to 7 o'clock, and Lars Larson, our noon to three host, with us here. Good morning, Lars.
Good morning, John. Lots of interesting things. The interview last night, I would have to agree with your take at 6 o'clock, and that is you didn't think she could do worse than she did on the previous interview she'd done, and she has managed to do exactly that. It's terrible.
Yeah, I mean, there were lots of lowlights, and I said, really?
Were there any highlights? I mean, can you name a single point where you say, wow, she really knocked that one out of the park?
No. Yeah. Now, I can tell you what her defenders will say. Her defenders will say, she went on Fox, and she didn't back down one bit. That's probably what they'll say.
But when you're asked, if 79% of Americans believe the country's on the wrong track, and you've been one of the people in charge, and according to Joe Biden, in the thick of it with authority to do whatever she wanted to do, and that's the way Joe has positioned it, then how do you explain that somehow January 20 or 21 is going to be a whole new world?
Right.
I hear my granddaughter singing A Whole New World.
Well, yes, here's how it sounded last night for those of you who didn't see the Bret Baier, Kamala Harris interview.
Debacle.
More than 70% of people tell the country is on the wrong track. They say the country is on the wrong track. If it's on the wrong track, That track follows 3.5 years of you being vice president and President Biden being president. That is what they're saying, 79% of them. Why are they saying that? If you're turning the page, you've been in office for 3.5 years.
And Donald Trump has been running for office.
But you've been the person holding the office.
Come on.
Madam
Vice
President.
You and I both know what I'm talking about. You and I both know what I'm talking about.
I actually don't. What are you talking about?
What I'm talking about is that over the last decade, people have become.
But
over the last decade, what? I mean, is she over the last decade goes back to the Harris-Biden administration or to the Biden-Obama administration.
Right. But do you remember, Lars, when I believe it was Lester Holt was asking her about what she was doing about the border because she was then the border czar and she had made a trip to Guatemala because they needed to find the root cause of illegal immigration. And, of course, we now know the root cause of illegal immigration was opening the darn gate.
Yep.
But the bottom line is he said, when are you going to go to the border? And she said, we've been to the border. We've been to the border. And she shook her head, you know, we've been to the border. And he said, you haven't been to the border. And what did she say?
I haven't been to Europe either.
And I haven't been to Europe. And
Change the subject altogether. And here's the thing, John.
Exactly what I thought when she said that last night.
If she wants to tell people things will be dramatically different, she was given golden opportunities a dozen times in the last month. What will be different in a Harris administration than a Biden administration? And she refuses to say.
That's because there won't be any difference. If there is any difference, the only difference will be that it would go further to the left. The only change we would see is going further in the direction that the American people don't want to go. They're dissatisfied with the results.
Absolutely right.
Lars Larson, every day of the work week from noon to 3 right here at Talk Radio 570 KVI. When we come back, are there non-citizens on Washington's voter rolls? If so, how many? And what do we do to safeguard against non-citizens being on our voting rolls? We'll talk to the Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs, about this in just a few minutes after your 7 o'clock headlines. The John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI, the radio program of record for the 17th day of October. As Philip J. Vandervoort III likes to say, it's Friday Eve or Thursday. And we're very pleased to have our Secretary of State, Steve Hobbs, joining us. The reason why is we want to talk about voting and citizenship. Some people say it's an act of citizenship. It's a responsibility of citizenship. But it is supposed to be limited to citizens. So how do we make sure that only citizens are on the voting rolls? We'll get to that in a minute. But first, a word about Steve Hobbs. He was appointed Secretary of State. He had been state senator from the Lake Stevens area for about 15 years and chaired the Transportation Committee, did a better job than the guy who's there now, but I don't want to get a field from where we are. He's an Army veteran and rose to the rank of lieutenant colonel with the Washington Army National Guard, deployed in Kosovo and Iraq. Married, father of three. We appreciate him making the time to join me again on the John Carlson Show. How are you, Secretary of State Hobbs?
Good morning, John. You know, I'm doing okay. Just, you know, 19 days left till the election. And I know you want to talk about Virginia, but, man, I saw what was going on in Oregon just recently. I'm glad I avoided a bullet there.
I'll let you explain the distinction between what happened in Oregon and let me start with Virginia. In Virginia, like in Washington, illegal immigrants can get driver's licenses. In Virginia, you have to check a box indicating whether or not you are a U.S. citizen. And if you check the box indicating you're not a citizen, you can get a license, but you also will not be registered to vote. If you do check that you're a citizen, then you are automatically registered to vote. Well, a law, an 18-year-old law, requires that they clean the voting rolls periodically, as you know we do here in Washington, including removing non-citizens from the voting rolls. And what do you know? They found that over 6,000 Virginia residents were on the voting rolls who were not U.S. citizens for one reason or another, clerical failure, you know, intentional fraud, who knows? All these people are on the rolls. So Virginia was removing them, and the Department of Justice told them they had to stop doing that, that it's too close to the election to remove people illegally by their own admission who are not citizens. It's wrong, illegal for them to remove them from the voting rolls. So Governor Youngkin is fighting this, and it's made the issue of citizenship and voting front and center. So I wanted to ask you, how do we do it here in Washington?
Sure. Over here in Washington, you know, we've got a couple of different systems. You know, when you get your driver's license, you will be asked to register to vote, but it's kind of similar to Virginia, where you have to, you know, you have to say that you are a U.S. citizen. You have to attest under threat of perjury, and you have to sign to that. And also, you're asked again the moment you get your ballot, because that's what you're doing when you're signing. You're attesting that you're an eligible voter. That's with just the normal driver's license. And here in the state of Washington, there's two different sets of driver's licenses, right? There's the enhanced and there's the normal. And then the enhanced, you are automatically registered. There's no one asks you. You're just automatically registered. You also have you can register using the last four of your Social Security number. But, you know, this state, there was an attempt to pass a law, in fact, just recently, that they wanted, they being the advocates of this, just automatically register under the normal driver's license without even asking or attesting to citizenship. I got a lot of heat for that, but I didn't want a situation to happen that's currently happening in Oregon, where several non-citizens were registered to vote
hundreds.
Because of this. Yeah, hundreds. And that is something that I, you know, I wanted to avoid. I felt that it was our system is the right way to do it. You should ask. And now they're running into that problem.
Okay. The bill, do you recall the sponsor of that bill?
I don't. But okay, we can certainly get that to you.
No, because
they're going to try to run it again.
It underscores something that I've been pointing out on the show for years, which is, there are people in government, in power, who, if they had their druthers, would not even require you to attest that you're a citizen before.
John, it's even worse than that, because there are laws trying to push non-citizens to hold local elected office. I don't know if you're aware of that bill that came up. I know we actually talked
about local elections. Yeah.
Yes. And I know they're going to, you know, they might try to bring it up again. And when I was at the Stranger interview, I know I was asked if I would support that. And I said no and got a little ridiculed for that. But the fact of the matter is, I mean, you have to have, it should be citizens who represent us until they become citizens.
Well, yes, that it's one of the things in the Constitution. If you want to vote in the United States, you have to be of age. It was 21 at the time of the Constitution was ratified, and the Constitution was amended in the early 70s to make it 18, lower the age to 18, and you have to be a U.S. citizen. Now, your office validates age to make sure that someone who says that. How do you validate citizenship?
So that it is through the process of through the attestation of you saying that you are a U.S. citizen. Now, then, of course, the question is, well, you know, how do you find out? You know, how do you get these folks? And, you know, we are part of multiple databases that talk to each other. But and we do have people that are accidentally signed up to be a registered voter that are non-citizens. So that is very rare. It doesn't happen very often. And what ends up happening is those individuals, when they find out, are removed from the voter rolls because they get a ballot, shows up at their house, or they get a little card that says you're a registered voter. And it really freaks them out because many of these folks are wanting to be U.S. citizens, and it puts their citizenship in jeopardy. And so we do get reports of that, you know, off and on. Again, it's not that many. It's usually from their attorneys that contact the either our office or their contact the county to remove them from the.
And don't you also get reports periodically of, hey, so-and-so is voting and I know them. Yes. I'm their neighbor. They're not citizens.
Yes, we get that. And any voter can do that. And county auditors will do that when they hear some. And not just non-citizens, but, you know, people not living in where they say they're not living, or someone who is. But we get reports for this is someone who goes to prison under a felony, and they're actually in prison. Well, you know, we get notified that in our database, including people who pass away.
Okay, so in Virginia, you have to mark a box, I am a citizen, I am not a citizen. And that makes it easy to check and find whether they're on the voting rolls or not. And again, they found over 6,000 who had checked the box, I am not a citizen, and then signed the registration or the driver's license registration form, and so they're removing them. Why don't we have that here in Washington? Why do we simply say, I attest I'm a U.S. citizen? It makes it hard to check.
So the difference is that we're, you know, being a vote-by-mail state, you know, everyone gets it, right? They get their ballot in the mail. Mm-hmm. And this is why we're self-policing ourselves, because in the rare moments, and again, very rare, when people are registered to vote when they're a non-citizen, and this could happen because you go to the you know, Department of Licensing and the person at the counter just, you know, whatever, they accidentally did it, or, you know, well, if they get a ballot in the mail, that's when they contact the office and remove themselves from the voter rolls, which, again, very rare. Now, in states like Virginia, when you don't have a vote by mail, you're not going to know until that particular person decides, well, I'm going to go vote today. I'm going to go walk to the polls. Well, we don't have that. So that's why.
Well, here's the question I have for you.
Registration system's good.
Steve, here's my question for you. Again, my guest is Secretary of State Steve Hobbs. We're talking about in the state of Virginia, which has a similar population to Washington. We're about 7.8 million, and Virginia is about 8.8 million. So it's similar population. They've got 6,000 non-citizens who are registered to vote via getting a driver's license, but they weren't supposed to because they had marked the box that said they're non-citizen. So if they've got about 6,000 people on the rolls, why is it unreasonable to assume that we've probably got about that many non-citizens on the rolls?
Again, because remember that state is a polling state. So I'm sure they had a bunch of, you know, probably non-citizens that were accidentally registered and they just never went to the polls, and so that nobody ever figured it out. Well, here you're going to get a ballot in the mail. And this is why we will, again, this is rare, but we'll get people that will contact either the county auditor or our office and go, hey, we're not supposed to get this.
Okay, but here's the point that I'm making here, because you're talking about when you're on the rolls illegally and you vote, and then sometimes it gets called out and sometimes it doesn't. Or when the ballot arrives, sometimes they'll say, I shouldn't be getting a ballot. What I'm talking about is just being on the voting rolls, being eligible to vote, mm-hmm. whether you do it at the polls or vote by mail, Steve, does I think is not the point here.
Sure.
What are we doing to make it easier to check citizenship mm-hmm. when we allow people to be registered to vote through driver's licensing?
Well, again, John, you know, I got to go with the laws of the state, right? So the laws of the state say that at the moment that you are, and this only is a narrow group of people who request the normal driver's license, right? The normal driver's yeah. license. And when they go there to the Department of Licensing, they have to attest under perjury. It is a Class C felony. You can go to prison. You can be deported. Those are the things that could happen to a non-citizen if they actually vote. The act of voting is the criminal act.
But isn't there a lady in Clark County who is not a citizen, who admits she's not a citizen, that she has been voting, that she's going to continue to vote, and the local prosecutor said, I'm not going to prosecute. This is much ado about very little. You've heard about this case.
I don't know about that case, but again, that is a Class C felony, and she's going to risk, you know, if she tries to become a U.S. citizen, she's probably going on the path. Probably not going to get it now.
Have we ever prosecuted someone for being a non-citizen and voting?
My understanding is that has happened. In this state, you have to have intent to do that. And my understanding has, I think, and that was several years ago before I became Secretary of State. Mm-hmm. We have also caught people who have voted multiple times, twice in the same election because of the databases that we have that talk to other databases in part of ERIC. And okay. we caught just recently 55 people who had passed away in the last election and their ballots came about. Now, in that case, these are people that were alive when they cast the ballot, because remember, vote by mail, get
sure.
18 days before, and then they died right after they dropped the ballot in the drop box or mailbox, but they were alive and they signed it. But we've also caught people where they were very clearly were dead. Now, those are very, very rare. But usually we catch those because with the database and the signature, and usually it's the spout, the widow or widower
right.
that signed for that individual.
By the way, how
grief.
How often do you cleanse the voting rolls?
Well, that is almost a daily effort because of the systems we have in place, because of ERIC. This is, you know, under Kim, when Kim had this,
Kim Wyman.
She was one of the founders of, Kim Wyman, with the ERIC system. We also communicate with the Department of Health and Social Security Administration okay. on our voter registration rolls. And we also contact other states who are not part of ERIC.
Last question then. Again, my guest, Secretary of State Steve Hobbs. Thank you, by the way, for making the time this morning, Steve.
Absolutely.
If there was a bill that did ask people to check a box, in other words, in writing, that they mm-hmm. are a citizen or are not a citizen, knowing that you can get a driver's license whether you're a citizen or not in Washington state. Would you favor such legislation?
I would prefer that we keep what we're doing by actually signing to a test under threat of perjury. Checking a box isn't really enough.
But you sign the registration form. So you'd have to sign the driver's registration form anyway.
Yeah, but if you agree to the being a voter, you have to attest. I mean, we have an attestation.
But it's easier to check. It's easier to check the rolls when someone indicates mm-hmm. that they're not a citizen, and then you can just run the voter registration rolls against the driver's license.
Oh, I'm sorry, John. I misunderstood what you're trying to say. I'm fine with that. I mean, if the legislature does that's fine. I don't know if they will or not.
They won't.
I just wanted to make sure that.
Okay.
I just wanted to make sure you weren't trying to remove the attestation and the threat of perjury from. So yeah.
Just have the most foolproof method possible. Steve Hobbs, I appreciate you taking the time to join me here on the Commute with Carlson, and look forward to talking again soon.
Yeah, thank you very much, John.
All right. Take care. It is 21 minutes after 7 o'clock in the morning on the Commute with Carlson. Philip J. around the corner with a social media sweep. Good morning. Philip J. Vandervoort III, what is going on in the social media world?
How about campaign news from Dave Reichert running for governor in the state of Washington? The social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. And, you know, the social media game is not going to be the forte of the Reichert campaign, but they posted something significant. Here's the message from the at Reichert for Gov social media handle. It is written, several weeks ago, I sat down, I guess meaning Dave Reichert, I sat down with PBS, I'm guessing he must mean KCTS here in Seattle, the public
KCTS
television.
Is the PBS affiliate.
Yeah, in Seattle.
Yes.
But he writes, with PBS for an interview on my race for governor. My opponent, Bob Ferguson, was supposed to do the same. Each of us were to get 30 minutes to make our case to voters. And that's roughly what the amount of time Brett Baer talked to Kamala Harris for last night, right around 27 minutes, sure. I think. Ferguson writes, this special was supposed to air this Friday evening, but PBS informed me this week that the interview would not be airing as scheduled. And I asked why. They said it's because Bob Ferguson backed out of the interview. Reichert goes on to state, this has been a theme throughout the campaign. Ferguson has run from a media that, in all honesty, favors him. As Attorney General, Ferguson's been forced to pay hundreds of thousands of dollars in fines for a lack of transparency. It's unfortunate he's taking the same approach with his campaign. Voters deserve transparency from their elected officials. And this goes to Bob Ferguson not being up for another debate after the Spokane debate, the second debate between Reichert and Ferguson. So whether or not PBS will go forward and air Reichert's interview since it was completed and just leave out Ferguson since he's decided to not participate, we'll have to remain to be seen.
They should. There's no equal time requirement when somebody's a no-show.
Exactly. I mean, Ferguson's been given an opportunity. If he declines it, you're out of luck.
To put it bluntly, Bob Ferguson should not decide that PBS, KCTS viewers don't get to see Dave Reichert.
Right.
Okay. He should not have, Bob Ferguson should not have veto over that. He should be given the same opportunity.
Exactly.
Same amount of time, same basic format. And if he shows, great. If he doesn't, well, then we go ahead with Reichert. The man is afraid, okay?
Ferguson.
He's a coward. He doesn't like to face people who disagree with him one-on-one.
Mm-hmm.
And he doesn't like to answer questions unless he knows they're coming from a friendly source. And if he can get the questions in advance, so much the better. The bottom line is this guy is afraid to face a reporter who's not already in his corner or his opponent in debate.
And Reichert's going to have to keep the pressure on KCTS PBS to make sure that they air what's already been set up with this interview between those two.
When I ran against Gary Locke in 2000, now Gary was the incumbent, and Gary had a large lead and plenty of advantages going for him. He still agreed to 3 one-on-one debates. Okay. Now we have an open race for governor. Could go either way. You've got two credible, viable contenders who've raised millions of dollars. And Ferguson, because Democrats have an edge in this state, is refusing to do a third debate. He tried to get out of doing the second debate and is pushing away the news media at every opportunity. So, again, to me, that shows that he's simply trying to stay away from the people rather than engage the people.
Yeah. Fox 13 is posting a story about the Washington director of the Department of Child, Youth, and Family Services. This is Ross Hunter.
And used to be a Bellevue legislator.
Right? Yeah. He's been heading up the State Department of Child and Youth Family Services.
He's had a tough year.
And he says he will be stepping down based on whoever takes over as the next governor. So an embattled Inslee administration secretary. And in a video statement, according to the Fox 13, Hunter said, I announced my leadership team that I would not be seeking reappointment to this position.
I don't think he would have gotten it.
New blood, right?
Yeah, for a number of reasons, things just have not worked out well for Ross. We've had
a lot of this revolves around the juvenile detention system that the state has and the Green Hill facility, which is the high security
it's the facility for hardcore juvenile offenders.
Chehalis, Centralia.
Yeah, there in Lewis County. It's right off the freeway. You can see it when you drive by
on I-5.
Which, by the way, they now allow adults, young adults, to
18-year-olds, 19-year-olds
to serve their sentences. And that has not worked out well at all. All right, it is 7:30 on the John Carlson Show. Still to come, Jay Inslee harshly attacks Brian Haywood in Spokane. And Welch, speaking of running away from the public, agrees to an interview with King TV and then changes his mind. And Susanna Frame will explain why he's probably changing his mind. That is all in front of us here on The Commute with Carlson. Washington has more statewide elective offices than any other state. Almost every state has an elected governor. Well, every state has an elected governor, and most states also have an elected attorney general and an elected lieutenant governor. Sometimes the lieutenant governor runs on a ticket with the governor. Sometimes the lieutenant governor runs as a standalone, as is the case here in Washington. But Washington also has just a flurry of other statewide offices. We elect an auditor. We elect a treasurer. We elect a lands commissioner. We elect an insurance commissioner. And it is completely understandable why a lot of people would just roll their eyes and say, I don't know what all these offices are really all about. I mean, the title suggests, you know, basic job descriptions. But other than that, you know, it just is overwhelming. Okay, I get it. But some of these statewide offices really have an impact on your pocketbook. And next to governor, the office that most influences and impacts your financial bottom line is insurance commissioner. Have you seen how much auto insurance has gone up? Just check your latest invoice from your friendly insurance company. Or your life insurance, or your property insurance. Insurance is handled with a great deal of latitude and leeway by the insurance commissioner and elective officer. And there's a lot of leeway and latitude they have there. So I wanted to bring Phil Fortunato, who is the Republican candidate for insurance commissioner, aboard, because the difference between he and his opponent, who has made it clear that she would like to be insurance commissioner so she could use her office as a platform to crusade for an end to private insurance, not lower cost private insurance, an end to it, and replacement with government-run health care. In other words, socialized medicine on a statewide basis. That is Patty Kutterher. She is currently an uber-liberal state senator from Bellevue. Phil Fortunato, Republican state senator from Enumclaw, has very different ideas and completely different priorities when it comes to the Office of Insurance Commissioner. He joins me this morning on The Commute with Carlson. Hello there, Phil. How are you?
Well, thank you, John, for putting so much emphasis on this particular race. I jokingly say, you know, this is the Rodney Dangerfield of all the races. It gets absolutely no respect. But as you point out, it is the number two race that affects everyone's wallet. What the insurance commissioner's office does affects your insurance rates for car insurance, health insurance, property insurance, everything. And, somebody said to me, why are you running? And I go, aside from the fact that we as Republicans cannot simply give these executive position races away without having a serious opponent. So a serious alternative for the voters to consider. And as you point out, Senator Cooter and I are diametrically opposed to one another. She is a very heavy government-centered answer to every problem. The government is the solution to health care, as you point out, socialized medicine. And I jokingly say, if Washington State had socialized medicine, where would the Canadians go for health care? Right? But in addition to that, it's your property insurance. It's your car insurance. All these things are affected by what the insurance commissioner does. And you have to ask yourself, why are other states going up at 5%, 7%, maybe 8%? And remember, that is largely because of Bidenomics. Cars cost more money. Take a car I bought my wife 6 years ago and got 50% more.
But answer that question because it's a good one. Why are insurance costs in Washington State higher than in most other states?
Ironically, the biggest reason insurance companies leave the state is because of the lack of ability of our insurance commissioner to issue rate increases.
I didn't hear what you said. You went out. Your microphone went out there. Maybe you had an incoming call or something. The biggest reason.
Lack of being able to have a timely rate increase. In other words, insurance companies are due rate increases for inflation. Things are costing more. Cars are costing more. Repairs cost more. Those are reasons why your insurance rates would increase. Other states approve rate increases in like 30 days, right? So you're looking at a rate increase more moderate. Because they know that they could get these rate increases approved pretty quickly. In Washington, in some cases, you're over 2 years. That's why in this case, you're getting a 30, 40, 50% rate increase in your insurances, because not only are you paying for rates going forward, but you're also paying for losses that they incurred going backwards. And ironically, that's one of the things. But insurance, for car insurance, for example, I want you to pull out your insurance rate and look at uninsured motorists, and it's like one-third of the cost of your car insurance. If your car insurance is like $1,200, mine's like $324 for uninsured motorists. You know what it is in Idaho? $18. And you have to ask yourself, why is that?
I'd rather ask you why, because I don't know. I'm not going to ask myself why. I'm going to ask you why. Why is Idaho $18 and in Washington your policy is over $300 just for uninsured motorists?
Because in Washington, for example, you need to show proof of insurance to buy a car, but you don't need to show proof of insurance to register your car. And we need to have tougher insurance requirements if you're going to drive a vehicle. Now, I am sympathetic to low-income people and the cost of insurance and all that, but you cannot be jeopardizing everybody else on the road by not having insurance, because we're paying for that. And that's one of the things that you really need to tighten up.
I want to ask you something else. How come insurance companies cannot take someone's credit rating into effect when they are quoting an insurance price?
Well, that actually was overturned, but that's the other policy. That is the thing that people don't realize that the insurance commissioner's office has. The insurance commissioner's office is 80% rulemaking. It's not law. Whoever you elect as insurance commissioner can go in there And they can simply say every insurance policy must include this. Or in the case of credit scores, for example, the insurance companies cannot use credit scores in order to evaluate your insurance rates, which, by the way, was a bill in the legislature that did not pass.
Okay.
So the bill didn't pass the legislature. And the insurance commissioner simply implemented that by rule. Now, the insurance company sued and got that overturned last year or so.
All right.
But that's an example. And Patty Cooterer wants to do that. If you're a gun owner, go on her webpage and take a look what she wants to do. She wants you to report your guns to the insurance commissioner and have a $1 million policy, not to protect you, but to protect your victim. And your victim is somebody who breaks into your house so that they have recompense to go after your $1 million policy. And this is an example of instituting policy by rule.
It's just madness.
And I do not believe that the insurance commissioner's office is a policy-making office. Mm-hmm. It should be out of that business. It should be the primary focus of the insurance commissioner is to be your advocate. If you have a problem with the insurance company, you go to the insurance commissioner. The insurance commissioner is your advocate to fight for your rights and make sure that the insurance company holds up their policy.
You're running against a Democrat in a Democrat state. Why can Phil Fortunato win this race?
Well, because, as you point out, wallet is affected by this. It's not only party. It's what the bottom line is and the effect on your family budget, especially seniors on fixed incomes. And I want to bring that to around to a circle. We need money to keep the ads rolling. So the ads are running now. They're digital ads. They're ads on cable TV. And we need money to keep that rolling. So if you want to have an alternative and have a Republican actually win, you need to be helping this campaign. So I'm hoping that your listeners will say, hey, you know what? I'm going to support this. I'm going to help keep insurance rates low. If Phil gets in there, he's going to fight to lower my insurance rates. If Patty gets in there, all bets are off.
Yeah.
So go to votefortunato.org and hit that contribute button.
Again, go to Fortunato.org.
Vote Fortunato.
Vote
Fortunato.
Fortunato.org. That is VoteFortunato.org. Folks, I think this is a very important race. That's why I'm bringing Phil on yet again to talk about it. Because number one, if he gets in, some very good things will happen. And second, if his opponent gets in, some not so good things, bad things will happen. So it's one of those. And there's not a lot of big money in this race so far. So this is, financially speaking, a much closer call than some of the other races. Go to votefortunato.org and be a part of what would be a great outcome if you win this race, Phil. I appreciate you making the time to join me. And one more time, votefortunato.org. And keep me updated on how things are going, all right? You got it, Phil. It is 12 minutes to 8 o'clock on The Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Boy, I tell you, you're going to want to be listening after the 8 o'clock headlines. We're going to be getting into Kamala Harris's train wreck of an interview with Bret Baier. You don't think she could do worse than she did on 60 Minutes? She did do worse, much worse. And we've got the receipts, and you'll be hearing them during our first segment in the 8 o'clock hour. Let's bring it home local very quickly. Seattle Shop hit twice in one night, broken into. The store is Turntables and Trails on Lake City Way. Its focus is on hiking, the outdoors, and music, hence Turntables and Trails. One-of-a-kind store. Obviously not a big corporate franchise or anything like that. They were broken into late Friday, and then broken into a second time in the early hours on Saturday morning, as, you know, Friday gave way to Saturday. The shop manager gave a very reasonable and candid answer to Como 4 when they asked him about the break-in. Once again, my microphone not potted up. Let's try this again. From the beginning. All right, here we go.
We feel like the city doesn't have our back, to be very honest with you.
David also wanted to point out this homeless camp right next door.
There's as many as 25 to 40 people there at any time. They're openly doing drugs. I'm talking hard drugs. As a human being, you feel for these people and you feel for their situation. But as a business owner and somebody who's working hard to bring something positive to the neighborhood, it's hard to have sympathy for people who don't want to be helped.
This guy says it so well. I mean, he's so reasonable. That's David Brisker, who manages Turntables and Trails. The shop does live shows a couple times a month, all-age shows, local bands. It's a great little place, and the city should be on their side. I say this over and over again. Is the city on the side of the good guys? Clearly, they are not. And they need to be. It is coming up here 4 minutes to 8 o'clock, the commute with Carlson. Let's get to your headlines, and then you got to hear this audio of Kamala Harris with Bret Baier last night. Wow.
The vice president trying to put a clear distance between herself and the administration she still serves in, but not pinpointing any major policy shifts.
Let me be very clear. My presidency will not be a continuation of Joe Biden's presidency.
But she doesn't say how it's going to be different, because it won't be. And if it was different, it would be even further to the political left than the Biden administration, which has been more liberal than any other administration in memory. And that's one reason for the catastrophic results we've seen here and abroad. Welcome, everybody. Hour number three of the John Carlson Show, Talk Radio 570 KVI. Your phone calls would be welcome at 206-421-5757. And if you're a little bashful about having your voice over the air, but you want your views over the air, well, that's why we have our text line, which is the same number. Text us your opinions or your questions at 206-421-5757. As I said during the 6 o'clock hour, I didn't think Kamala Harris could do worse in an interview than she did on 60 Minutes with Bill Whitaker. And we ran the excerpts of that. And that was just a complete embarrassment. It got to the point where you almost felt embarrassed for Kamala Harris. And Bill Whitaker's kind of a mild-mannered veteran correspondent there for 60 Minutes, was asking all the right questions, and she was floundering. Well, she can do worse than she did with Bill Whitaker, and she did worse yesterday against Bret Baier. Let's start with what she had to say about immigration. It was the first question out of the chute when Bret Baier sat down with Kamala Harris. The interview lasted about 25 minutes. Towards the end of the interview, Kamala Harris's team were waving their arms, signaling they wanted it wrapped up. We'll actually give you a little bit of insight into what was going on behind the scenes there coming up. But here is how she handled first question, big interview with Bret Baier, of course, is going to be about the border.
Thank you for the time.
Thank you. It's good to be with you, Bret.
You know, voters tell pollsters all over the country and here in Pennsylvania that immigration is one of the key issues that they're looking at this election, and specifically the influx of illegal immigrants from more than 150 countries. How many illegal immigrants would you estimate your administration has released into the country over the last 3.5 years?
Well, I'm glad you raised the issue of immigration because I agree with you. It is a topic of discussion that people want to rightly have.
Let's see if she actually answers his question.
And you know what I'm going to talk about.
Yeah, but
right
do you
now,
just a number. Is, do you but, think it's but, 1 million, 3 million?
Brett, let's just get to the point. Okay, the point is...
I thought the point was his question, but let's continue.
That we have a broken immigration system that needs to be repaired.
So your Homeland Security Secretary said that 85% of apprehensions...
I'm not finished. We have
an immigration system... It's a rough estimate of 6 million people have been released into the country. And let me just finish. I'll get to the question, I promise you.
I was beginning to answer.
And when you came into office, your administration immediately reversed a number of Trump border policies. Most significantly, the policy that required illegal immigrants to be detained through deportation, either in the U.S. or in Mexico. And you switched that policy. They were released from custody awaiting trial. So instead, included in those were a large number of single men, adult men, who went on to commit heinous crimes. So looking back, do you regret the decision to terminate Remain in Mexico at the beginning of your administration?
At the beginning of our administration, within practically hours of taking the oath, the first bill that we offered Congress, before we worked on infrastructure, before the Inflation Reduction Act, before the CHIPS and Science Act, before the bipartisan Safer Communities Act, the first bill, practically within hours of taking the oath, was a bill to fix our immigration system.
Yes, ma'am. It was called the U.S. Citizenship Act of 2021.
Exactly.
It was essentially a pathway to citizenship for the...
May I finish responding,
but
please?
But
you have to let me finish,
you
please.
Had the White House and the House and the Senate,
I'm
and they didn't bring up that bill.
I'm in the middle of responding to the point you're raising,
okay.
And I'd like to finish.
Yes.
Yeah, except she was kind of filibustering and not answering the question. Do you know how long she went on there without answering his question? 2.5 minutes. And it became kind of obvious what she was doing. And keep in mind something. The Remain in Mexico program of President Trump, that was not a bill that he signed into law. That was just him using his discretion as president to strike a deal with Mexico. And that deal was in place. And the border pretty well secure on the day they walked into office. And they reversed the policy. And you know what happened when they reversed the policy? They reversed the results of holding immigration down to reasonable levels. And it skyrocketed. So let's continue. Brett Baer commendably continues his line of questioning. He asks about the three well-known cases of illegals who were charged with attacking and murdering women, starting with the case of a 12-year-old girl named Jocelyn Nungari.
Jocelyn Nungari, Rachel Morin, Lakin Riley, they are young women who were brutally assaulted and killed by some of the men who were released at the beginning of the administration, well before a negotiated bipartisan bill. Former President Clinton actually referred to Lakin Riley Sunday, campaigning for you in Georgia, saying if those men had been properly vetted, Lakin Riley probably would not have been killed. So if it wouldn't have happened, this is well before any negotiation. This is well before Donald Trump got involved in the politics. This is a specific policy decision by your administration to release these men into the country. So what I'm saying to you,
do you owe those families an apology? Let me just say, first of all, those are tragic cases. There's no question about that. There's no question about that. And I can't imagine the pain that the families of those victims have experienced for a loss that should not have occurred. So that is true. It is also true that if a border security had actually been passed 9 months ago, it would be 9 months that we would have had more border agents at the border, more support for the folks who are working around the clock trying to hold it all together.
Madam Vice President.
To ensure that no future harm would occur. And this election in 20 days will determine whether we have a president of the United States who actually cares more about fixing a problem, even if it is not to their political advantage in an election, because there was a solution, Brett.
Madam Vice President, it was a policy decision in the early part of your administration. I will let one of the mothers talk about it. Take a listen.
Because of the Biden-Harris administration open border policies catch and release, they were enrolled in the Alternatives to Detention program. This meant that they were released into the United States. It was not even a full 3 weeks later that they would take my daughter Jocelyn Nungare's life. I believe the Biden-Harris administration open border policies are responsible for the death of my daughter.
That's the early days. So do you owe them an apology is what I'm saying.
I will tell you that I am so sorry for her loss. I am so sorry for her loss. Sincerely.
I'm sorry for her loss and not taking responsibility that your policy led to this attack. Have you following how she just refuses to accept any responsibility for this attack? She keeps talking about that terrible bill that, thank goodness, Donald Trump and, by the way, plenty of other Republicans and some Democrats opposed. But even if they had favored it, this poor girl was already dead. This was a result of their policy of releasing illegals, often with little or no vetting.
But let's talk about what is happening right now with an individual who does not want to participate in solutions. Let's talk about that as well.
But do you want to answer
in all fairness, I told you, I feel awful for what she and her family have experienced.
All right. What about the issue of Donald Trump's mental fitness? Because Kamala Harris was very eager to talk about this. And Brett Baer lets her talk about it, and then he asks a question that appears to have stunned her. Have a listen.
You called Donald Trump.
Let's not diminish the significance of that.
You called Donald Trump. He's misguided. You say now
he's unstable. He is unstable, Brett.
He's not well. You say he's mentally not stable.
He's not stable.
Let me ask you this. You told many interviewers that Joe Biden was on his game, that ran around circles on his staff. When did you first notice that President Biden's mental faculties appeared diminished?
Joe Biden.
Boom.
I have watched in from the Oval Office to the Situation Room.
He asked that question. When did you notice Joe Biden's diminishing capacity? Because it took her about 2.5 seconds before she started addressing that question. And then you realize here she is saying that Donald Trump is unstable. Donald Trump is mentally unfit. Donald Trump is too old. And they said, well, when did you begin to notice this about Joe Biden? And she just stops. Because she was probably the lead cheerleader insisting that Joe Biden was just fine. That he had, that as Brett Baer said, he runs circles around his staff. He's so energetic. He's so engaged. You ought to see him in private. He is really on the ball.
And he has the judgment and the experience to do exactly what he has done in making very important decisions on behalf of the American people.
Joe Biden, no concerns raised?
Joe Biden is not on the ballot.
I understand.
And Donald Trump
but
is.
But you talked about it.
And Donald Trump
after
is.
After George Clooney said within a few minutes of talking to
Donald
President Biden
Trump,
at a fundraiser that he thought this was not the same Joe Biden that we saw on the debate stage.
Donald Trump is on the ballot.
I understand. You met with him at least once a week for 3.5 years. You didn't have any concerns?
I think the American people have a concern about Donald Trump.
Yeah, I think they have concerns now about Kamala Harris. Anyway, we got more to play for you. More. The hits just keep coming off this interview. But let's get to your phone calls. Tanya is calling. KVI listener listening to us in Texas on KVI.com. I love that. Tanya, good morning. How are you?
Hey, good morning, John. It's a beautiful day here. I noticed that her body language was very close. She had her legs crossed. She had her arms crossed.
Yeah.
She was bent in. She went in and sounded like she had a chip on her shoulder. She was late. So the interview was supposed to go 45 minutes. Mm-hmm. She was 15 to 20 minutes late. So,
and as it was, they were waving for him. Her people were waving for him to cut off the interview, to cut it short.
Oh, yeah. They didn't like the questions one bit. And she was so hostile and lied. And you just saw, if you're conservative or if you're even an independent, you saw how very evil she can be.
Well, no, this is the real, you saw how peeved she was.
Yeah, oh, good when, word. Very peeved.
When he was asking very relevant questions that she should have been asked by now. If the media had been doing his job, they would have asked her these questions.
Totally agree.
Country is, you know, 80, between 70 and 80%. The people think that the country is off on the wrong track. You've been there for 3.5 years. Why do you think that is? Nobody's asked her that until Bret Baier did.
No, so, nobody asked her.
And about these immigration questions.
Softball, mm-hmm. Right, she's had all these softball interviews. They've done her no favors by doing that.
Great call. Thank you very much. Up to Lacey. Just north of the state capitol in Olympia. Gary from Lacey, good to have you with us. Go for it.
Yeah, good morning. Lacey is either north or east, depending on your own...
Where you live. Okay. Okay.
Well, I do live in Lacey. I just want to say I was absolutely thrilled at Bret Baier's performance yesterday. I take him as a true model of what we ought to be always doing is holding people's feet to the fire and demanding answers rather than just listening to the charge that Donald Trump is a Nazi, as opposed to raising the simple questions. Well, where are the 6 million people that Donald Trump is? And so forth and so on.
Well, yeah, no, and I thank you for the call. It's a very good point that now they're getting so desperate that you had James Carville, who was Bill Clinton's campaign manager over 30 years ago, calling Donald Trump a Nazi and saying that he is going to round people up, his political opponents up, including black people. That is what James Carville said. We played you the tape. Much of the rest of the media is just quietly tiptoeing away. They're not condemning him for saying that. And just day before yesterday, Kamala Harris trying to scare the black vote, particularly young black men, into voting for her, appears on a radio show. They take calls and... Sure enough, someone calls in and says, I hear that Donald Trump really intends to invoke a long ago federal law so he can start locking people up, starting with people who are non-white. And what did Kamala Harris say? That's an important point. And you phrased it so well. Again, these people are creating a toxic environment. They're getting ugly because they're losing, and they know it. Philip J. Vandervoort III right around the corner with social media from Socialists on The John Carlson Show. The Commute with Carlson, Philip J. Vandenbort III standing by with his favorite segment of the day, social media from socialists.
Let's continue with this coverage and all this focus and attention. That's where most of the news and political world is this morning on the Bret Baier, Kamala Harris interview. Social media sweep sponsored by Muckleshoot Casino Resort. On her own campaign social media account, Kamala Harris posted a clip of the interview. And she posted the clip, and she, the campaign anyways, puts it down this way. Vice President Harris to Fox, my presidency will not be a continuation of Joe Biden's presidency. Like every new president, I will bring my life experiences, my professional experiences, and fresh new ideas. I represent a new generation of leadership. And let's just take this back to a couple of weeks ago about how this is another 180-degree turn by Kamala Harris. Here's the question when she was on The View and asked if she would change anything from the Biden years.
Well, if anything, would you have done something differently than President Biden during the past 4 years?
There is not a thing that comes to mind in terms of, and I've been a part of most of the decisions that have had impact.
So she's trying to have it both ways, it appears.
Of course. And yeah. Well, here's what she's trying to do. She's trying not to antagonize Joe Biden while knowing that he's dragging her down.
Yeah.
The bottom line is, she's a woman. He's a man. She's in her 50s. He's in his 80s and appears to be 114 at times. The bottom line here is, other than appearances, everything remains the same.
Yeah.
And if she does change, it would be to go even further in the political left, toward the political left, which is responsible for the policies that have so many people ticked off right now.
Yeah. How about some defenders of Kamala Harris on social media? We'll start with this one. Rex Chapman is a former NBA basketball player.
Yep.
He's busy on social media. Every once in a while, he gets pulled on something like CNN to do a little panel and chit-chat talking politics. And he posted this about the Fox interview last night. Imagine thinking you can intimidate and steamroll a lifelong prosecutor, that being Kamala Harris. What's more, we're talking about a woman with a remarkable poise, stoicism, and grace. Think about the number of times she's been counted out, underestimated, and the countless times she's been subjected to microaggressions and outright aggressions. People who underestimate her are playing with fire. Now, I'll stipulate Rex Chapman might not be the typical socialist progressive, but one of the first comments in the thread essentially echoes exactly what Rex Chapman just posted. And this person's social media profile says, pro-democracy, anti-fascism, expand the court, we will beat Trump again. And he writes, the entire Republican Party continue to underestimate her. And I keep telling them, you underestimate Kamala Harris at your own peril, she's going to win. And she may win, but this whole idea of underestimating her, that's a five-yard penalty for reaching.
She's not going to be under. She's not going to win because she's not being underestimated, and the forces behind her most certainly should not be underestimated.
Yeah.
Bottom line here is, I love how they're struggling. Her defenders are struggling to find ways to say, "Oh, she was. She didn't back down.
Right.
She was strong.
It was a good interview
she
for her.
Went on. Okay. Great.
Exactly. Yeah. Wow. Pull this leg and it plays Jingle Bells.
It's 30 minutes after 8. Yes, we've got more clips. Want to bring up Jay Inslee. Stepping in it big time. You'll hear that on The Commute with Carlson as we roll along this Thursday morning. It's 8:30. Big news just breaking. The Israeli Defense Forces have eliminated the leader of Hamas, the mastermind responsible for the October 7th slaughter of Israeli 1,200 Israeli civilians, the wounding and injuring of 5,000 more, and the taking of 250-plus hostages, Yahya Sinwar, I've been telling you about this guy, was killed yesterday in southern Gaza. Sinwar was sighted walking into a building with two other terrorists, and a strike was ordered against it. three terrorists were killed. Photos are already circulating online that appear to show Sinwar's body trapped under rubble with a massive hole on his forehead. Apparently, a slab of concrete fell on him. I cannot tell you how important this is for not only Israeli Jewish morale, but also, quite frankly, peace. Peace in the Middle East. This man, I've said it before, is the closest thing we have to Satan walking the earth. Just yesterday, I was telling you that Yahya Sinwar was calling for Palestinian Muslims to begin bringing back suicide bombing, which he used to champion 20 years ago, where someone would strap explosives to their body and walk into, let's say, a coffee shop, a pizzeria, a school, and kill as many Jews as possible, and then be celebrated as a martyr. They stopped doing that when Israel constructed a security wall and began clamping down on likely suspects. But with Hamas being annihilated on the battlefield, hiding behind women and children and other civilians, which is what they do, because these barbarians in Hamas, they have no honor. No honor whatsoever. Sinwar likes to see dead Jews. You know what else he likes to see? Well, he liked to see dead Arabs, dead Muslims, because he thinks it helps their cause. Well, now he's one of them. And normally I do not take pleasure at the death of somebody, but I am really happy that Israel nailed this guy and put him in the rearview mirror. This is someone who glories in killing Jewish civilians. Because you not only have fewer Jews, but you've scared the rest of them. And, you know, the problem with Israel's government is they should have eliminated this guy a long time ago. He actually was a prisoner and was handed over in a incredibly one-sided hostage exchange. Hundreds and hundreds of convicted Arab Muslim terrorists and criminals were swapped for a Jewish kidnapped soldier named Gilad Shalit. That was over a dozen years ago. But Sinwar went on to become a growing force within Hamas, very charismatic, and the young militants loved him because he was the most hardcore. And he, like I said, he was the architect of, here's what we do next. We spend 2 years lulling Israel into believing that we were no longer a threat, that the tension level was melting, that there was, you know, no drama. And just as Israel starts to relax on a Jewish holiday weekend, we attack. And that is exactly what October 7th was all about. Notice they didn't go after soldiers. Wasn't their target. They went after kids at a dance festival. They went after people living in a commune farm called a kibbutz. They went after people driving down the highway. They went after people living in neighborhoods who posed no threat to them whatsoever. Again, these people are cowards. And after and encouraging the raping, encouraging the torturing of civilians, Sinwar was doing all of that. There was never any regret for the horrific ways in which hundreds of Jews were killed. Sinwar seemed to like it because that's going to really terrify the Jews. This is not a guy who wanted a two-state solution. He just wanted all the Jews gone. And instead, now he's gone. So, again, the big news of the day. Yahya Sinwar, the bin Laden of Gaza, the mastermind of terror, biggest loss of Jewish life since the Holocaust, biggest one-day loss of life for Jews since the Holocaust. Sinwar was blown up in a IDF strike on a building that he and a couple of other terrorists had entered. So this is wonderful, wonderful news. All right, you've got 44 minutes after 8 o'clock. Let's get to how did we talk about the, you mentioned the ABC News report about last night's interview with Bret Baier and Kamala Harris. And 2 weeks ago, of course, she had said that she can't think of anything she would have done different during the Biden administration. Now she says this will not be a continuation of the Biden presidency, but she doesn't say what she would have done different. Here's how the interview eventually ended here.
I think this interview is supposed to be about the choices that your viewers should be presented about this election, and the contrast is important.
Yes, ma'am.
And on the subject of Iran, I am offering what should be an important contrast that is presented for folks to make a decision that they feel.
Who look at what the administration did and say and think differently. Madam Vice President, they're rapping me very hard here. I hope you got to say what you wanted to say about Donald Trump. There are a lot of things.
There's more to say. I have
there,
much more
there
to
are
say,
a lot
actually.
Of things that people want to learn about you and your policies.
Yes.
And that's why we invited
you. I invite everyone
here.
To go to KamalaHarris.com. And you will see that I have 80 pages of policies that are quite comprehensive and should be accessible to anyone who would like to read them. And it includes what I intend to do about affordable housing, what I intend to do about small businesses, what I do.
And that's why we invited you here,
our economy,
to see where you were in 2019 and where you are now.
America's military and ensure we have the most lethal and best fighting force in the world.
Madam Vice President,
and
they're giving me a hard rap.
Well,
here.
I thank you for the time.
I thank you for the
it's
time.
It's good to meet you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Okay, when he said they, he was referring to her people. Her people were like giving him the roundabout, hey, wrap it up, wrap it up, wrap it up. And here's Bret Baier speaking with his colleagues on Fox about the conclusion of the interview.
Dana, you've been on the other side. You've been on the...
He's referring to Dana. Oh, my goodness. Why am I zoning on Dana's last name? The former press secretary for Bush, Dana Perino. And so he's referring to you've been on the other side as a press secretary.
The rapper as a press secretary interviewing a president. And, you know, I'm talking like four people waving their hands like it's got to stop. So, Martha, final. Yeah, I had to dismount there at the end.
Okay. You know what they should have done? I think that one of them should have just thrown a towel between Brett Baer and Kamala Harris.
Yeah. Isn't that what happens at a prize fight?
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. You throw in the towel. Just
you got a technical knockout.
This.
The TKO.
We've got to go. All right.
Referee Mills Lane has called the fight.
47 minutes after 8 o'clock, the Commute with Carlson, Talk Radio 570 KVI. All right. Boy, again, big news on the political front here and abroad. The big news locally was Kamala Harris's interview with Brett Baer, which did not go well for her at all. We've played you plenty of clips about this. Not only that, but on the international front, the news that Yahya Sinwar, the leader of Hamas, has apparently been killed. He had rejected a ceasefire proposal from the Israelis months ago that would have allowed him safe passage out of the country, even though he is public enemy number one. Like I said, he's the bin Laden of the Middle East. And he rejected it. Hardline militant and the closest thing to the devil walking that we've had in this world. So that is incredibly important news. I had mentioned that Jay Inslee had been asked by Susanna Frame on camera if he would submit to an interview because he was avoiding King. They wanted him to document his environmental record. And he said yes, and then basically changed his mind and did not give them an interview. So Susanna Frame was wrapping up the discussion with her colleagues on the set at King.
Well, we weren't able to speak with Governor Inslee. We did hear from his press secretary in emails. He said, we are really blowing it here at King by not featuring the governor's whole climate strategy, including the carbon pricing program that's already raised more than $1.5 billion to go toward fighting climate change. I also asked in the email, you know, can you share with us some of the wins? What are you proud of? What goals have we met? But as you can see on the tape there, we didn't get an answer from the governor about that.
Really hard to hit the target or know that you've hit the target, let everyone else know you've hit the target if we can't see it.
Yes, and when this program, Results Washington, was first rolled out, it was really heralded as a national leader, a national model in state government accountability, but somehow things kind of...
I mean, if you're not hitting your mark, just say you're not hitting your mark, be transparent about it, but I don't know why the... standoffishness.
Yeah.
Well, I know.
We'll see
if
they make changes.
We'll see.
I know why the standoffish, because he's got nothing to brag about and he's got plenty to hide. And they're not even keeping track of so-called emissions reductions, which shows that this is really just a gambit to raise money, to raise taxpayer money in the form of higher gas prices. That's really what all this whole thing has been about. That's all the time we have for now. Get out there, enjoy this day. Let's talk again tomorrow.